IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Security official says the Western countries that provoked the recent riots in Iran have set conditions now to withdraw their support for the unrest. Britain's Labour Party calls the House of Lords indefensible, vowing to abolish it if the party wins the 2025 general elections. Also ahead, Russia says NATO poses a serious threat to Moscow, warning that the West's moves carry the risk of a direct clash between nuclear powers. Our top story. Since the beginning of the recent riots in Iran, the country's officials have repeatedly blamed certain Western countries for fueling the violence. Now, a security source says those same Western countries have set out no less than four conditions for renouncing their support for the rioters. The source told Iran's Al Alam News Network that the Western countries have demanded that Iran unconditionally inject its oil and gas into the global energy market in the current critical climate. Agreeing to Western positions in the standoff over Iran's nuclear program was another term specified. And the two other conditions entailed Iran going along with Saudi Arabia on regional issues and not cooperating with Russia. The riots in Iran broke out after the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and died at a hospital days later. Iran says more than 200 people, including security forces, innocent people, as well as rioters, have been killed in the unrest. Following reports of a three-day strike by shopkeepers in Tehran and other cities across Iran, Yusuf Jalali took a tour around the Iranian capital to investigate the matter.
Planned nationwide strikes were supposed to start on Monday across Iran, based on social media posts that have been calling for business owners to roll down their shutters for 3 days. A quick stroll on the streets of Tehran, however, shows that all the fuss is limited to the virtual world.
Life goes on as normal here in this district. I think social media exaggerates the problems. From what I saw today, no one is paying attention to the calls for a strike.
The country has been gripped by street violence for 10 weeks now, with anti-government protests claiming the lives of civilians and security forces. Now the same protesters have called for a three-day strike, marking the anniversary of the National Student Day in the country.
Student Day belongs to the Islamic Revolution and is a manifestation of the repression exercised by the former Pahlavi regime against our people. So it can't be used to protest against the Islamic establishment. I'm certain that all of the plots hatched to cause trouble to our country are doomed to failure.
Videos circulating on social media show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. However, people say some shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism by protesters.
Everyone is busy with their businesses today. There are some shops which have been closed, but the majority of them fear possible damage by protesters.
The Islamic Republic says what's happening on social media is not a true reflection of what's actually going on the ground. Over the past days, Iranian officials have been calling for a national dialogue to, quote, stop the enemy from fishing in troubled waters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
For the first time in Iran and West Asia, organs have been harvested from three donors after they were declared deceased, helping save the lives of patients in need. The operation was carried out by a knowledge-based company It entailed harvesting a kidney, a liver, pancreas, intestines, and a heart valve. The procedure has been approved by the Middle East Society for Organ Transplantation. Organ harvesting and transplants from patients post-cardiac, that is, or brain death, have been performed for years in Iran. But this is the first time a post-mortem organ donation procedure has been carried out in the country and in West Asia. Israeli forces killed yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the 23-year-old Omar Manah was shot at the Dehesha refugee camp near Bethlehem this morning. He was reportedly hit in the chest by live fire. Six others were also injured by the Israeli fire. The Hamas resistance movement slammed the Israeli regime over the extra judiciary killing of the young man, promising that the Palestinian people will stand steadfast in the face of the Israeli aggression. Meanwhile, Palestinian factions in the Bethlehem area have declared a general strike and a day of mourning. Israeli forces have been killing Palestinians in the occupied West Bank almost on a daily basis now. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in the Palestinian territories so far this year. We earlier spoke to our West Bank correspondent, Mona Kandil, for more details on the latest Israeli raid in the area.
Israeli forces raided the Dehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem to conduct an arrest campaign. This is according to a statement issued by the Israeli military. The Israeli soldiers stormed a number of houses in a Dehesha refugee camp. Of course, Palestinians have resisted the incursion or the raid of the Israeli forces to a Dehesha refugee camp. Clashes took place between Palestinian youths and Israeli forces. As you have mentioned, 23-year-old Omar Manah was shot and killed during this operation. Six others were wounded as well. And the Israeli forces arrested three Palestinians. Two of them are brothers. The Israeli military accuses those Palestinians who were detained in a Dehesha refugee camp that they are engaged in a number of anti-Israeli activities. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, another raid had taken place to Jenin area. This time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to arrest Palestinian activist and fighter. He is the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior leader of the Jihad movement, and he's also a Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. The Israeli forces said the main aim to Jenin incursion is to arrest the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior official of the Jihad movement in northern occupied West Bank.
Turning to other news now, the Russian foreign minister says NATO poses a serious threat to Moscow and warns that the West's positions risk a direct clash between nuclear powers.
In the context of the West's efforts to hold Russia back, the main threat comes from the general US and NATO line for what is, in reality, a military confrontation with our country. Obviously, it carries the risk of a direct clash between nuclear powers with catastrophic consequences.
Lavrov also said he regretted that the U.S. had rejected talks with Moscow over strategic stability, a host of issues related to nuclear weapons. He said that without direct talks between the world's two largest nuclear powers, the risk to global security will only grow. Lavrov said one of the drivers of current international tensions is the fact that NATO turned down Russia's proposal to provide it with security guarantees. He was referring to security talks between Russia and NATO last January, which ended without any breakthrough. Weeks later, Russia launched what it called a special military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia says Ukraine has launched the drone attacks on two of its air bases hundreds of miles away from the front lines.
In the morning of December 5th of the current year, the Kiev regime, in order to disable Russian long-range aircraft, made attempts to strike with Soviet-made jet unmanned aerial vehicles at the military airfields Diaghilevo in the Ryazan region and Engels in the Saratov region. Ukrainian UAVs flying at low altitude were intercepted by the air defense of the Russian aerospace forces.
Russia says three of its military personnel were killed and four more wounded as a result of the fall and explosion of the wreckage of the drones. The ministry called the attacks a terrorist act aimed at disrupting its long-range aviation. Now, Ukraine has not directly claimed responsibility, but if it did carry out the attacks, they would be the deepest strikes it has conducted inside the Russian heartland since the start of the war in February. Moscow said it responded with a massive strike on the Ukrainian military communications and energy centers in which all 17 targets were hit. Ukraine said it shot down more than 60 of over 70 missiles launched by Russia on Monday. And a price cap on the Russian oil export announced by the European Union and the group of seven developed countries has come into effect. The Western move is aimed at limiting Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The EU has also banned all imports of seaborne crude from Russia, apart from placing a $60 price cap on Russian oil. The measure jointly taken by the EU and the G7 mean third-party countries cannot use Western tankers, insurance firms, and credit institutions if the cargo is sold at a price higher than the designated ceiling. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the price cap will roil global energy markets further, but won't affect Russia's ability to fund its military operation in Ukraine. Peskov says Moscow is preparing how it would respond to the move. Russia has said it won't sell its oil to countries that apply the price cap. Jerome Hughes says there are doubts the price cap announced by G7 on Russian oil will have the desired effect.
It doesn't seem to be maybe having the desired effect, especially when you have a case. I mean, you mentioned about the G7 countries and the EU countries. Those tankers won't be able to go above this cap. But actually, Russia itself has plenty of its own tankers. And you already have the likes of China, which has said that it is happy to go with the status quo with its current arrangements with Russia in terms of its energy supplies. And of course, China is a major customer, it's a major consumer of oil. So actually, you know, the EU and the G7 countries are saying this is designed to try and stop Russia's war machine. Well, actually, you know, in terms of what we've seen so far with all of these energy restrictions that they've tried to impose on Russia. Well, actually, one of the main beneficiaries so far has been the United States, because it produces plenty of its own gas and oil. So it's been able to sell gas, for example, liquefied natural gas to the EU at huge prices. So actually, it's doing very well. But the bloc that's really struggling are the 27 countries of the EU that are really struggling to find energy at a reasonable price.
Elsewhere, Britain's Labour Party has vowed to abolish the upper chamber of Parliament, or the House of Lords, as part of a constitutional revamp if it wins the 2025 general elections.
Labour will rebuild trust by reforming the centre of government, cleaning up sleaze, nourishing the relationship between central government and the devolved authorities, and replacing the unelected House of Lords with a new, smaller, democratically elected second chamber.
Now, Starmer called the House of Lords, quote, indefensible. He said the move will be the biggest transfer of power from Westminster to the British people. The blueprint for reform was drafted by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, but the latest pledge comes as the country is suffering from economic turmoil and a cost of living crisis. The draft is yet to be discussed, and if agreed on, it will be incorporated in the party's election manifesto. The House of Lords includes a mixture of political appointees and hereditary, that is, peers, as well as senior bishops. Let's stay in the UK, where hundreds of workers at a housing charity have launched an unprecedented two-week strike, joining other walkouts in the private and public sectors. More than 600 workers at the charity began industrial action in what their union described as a bitter dispute over pay. Nurses, teachers, lawyers, train workers, and dock workers are among the other groups that have gone on strikes. They are angry at the cost of living crisis and the insufficient pay rises that do not keep up with the inflation rate. Just last week, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers said more than 40,000 workers would stage strikes in December and January, signaling major Christmas disruptions. The UK government is now considering using the military's help to fill in for striking workers ahead of key walkouts by nurses and ambulance staff. South Africa's National Assembly has delayed by a week a parliamentary vote that could lead to the impeachment of the embattled president. The Parliament's Programming Committee unanimously agreed that the vote be held on December 13th. The postponement was agreed to allow time for lawmakers to travel to Cape Town to physically vote through an open ballot and a roll call. The lawmakers are due to debate a report submitted by a special inquiry last week into corruption allegations against Cyril Ramaphosa. He is accused of covering up a $4 million cash robbery at his farm in 2020. However, the president denies all of the allegations against him. Sudan's military and civilian leaders have signed an initial deal aimed at ending the political crisis in the country. The deal provides for a two-year civilian-led transition toward elections. It was signed by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and by multiple civilian groups, including the Forces for Freedom and Change. That is the main civilian faction that was ousted in last year's coup, which triggered the unrest in the African country. The coup led to more than a year of mass protests against the military. Over 120 people are said to have been killed in the ensuing protests. And that wraps up World Bulletin for this hour.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Brexit has badly affected British low-income families. British low-income families spend a greater share of their income on food, and the impact of Brexit on their purchases was disproportionately greater. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The British Daily Guardian wrote in this regard, Brexit added almost £6 billion to UK food bills in the 2 years to the end of 2021, affecting poorest households the most. Research has found the cost of food imported from the EU shot up because of extra red tape, adding £210 to the average household food bills over 2020 and 2021, London School of Economics, LSE researchers discovered. As low-income families spend a greater share of their income on food, the impact of Brexit on their purchases was disproportionately greater, they said. The research comes today after data from the British Retail Consortium trade body showed UK food price inflation hit a record high of 12.4% in November, as the price of basics such as eggs, dairy products and coffee rose. Researchers at the Centre for Economic Performance, CEP, at the LSE studied micro data tracking trade flows and consumer prices for food products in the UK to identify the transfer of the cost of Brexit red tape to householders. We find that leaving the European Union increased the price of food products by 3% a year, leading to a 6% increase over a two-year period, they say in their report named Non-Tariff Barriers and Consumer Prices. Evidence from Brexit. Its calculations translated to a £5.84 billion cost to the food market alone, equating to £210 per household. CEP found the Brexit-induced price rise led to an overall cost of living increase for the poorest households of 1.1%, 52% more than 0.7% rise felt in top 10% of households in Britain. In 2015, the year before the referendum, 77% of food imports were from the EU. After the December 2019 election, researchers found an immediate rise in food prices from the EU as businesses reliant on products and ingredients immediately began to pass on to consumers. The cost of customs, administration staff and other Brexit staff, the report says. Regulatory costs varied according to product, with fresh red meat products identified as having a high non-tariff barrier NTB cost because of the paperwork required, but vegetables such as onions, carrots, and broccoli having close to zero NTB cost. Researchers found price rises on products with high NTBs with little significant cost for products in the low or zero NTB categories. CEP said the EU single market was a deep trading bloc that eliminated tariffs but also regulatory differences on food standards, allowing frictionless trade between member states, including the UK before Brexit. Lord Frost Brexit trade deal, signed at the end of the transition period in December 2020, ensures trade is tariff-free with the EU but created trade barriers in the form of customs, rules of original paperwork, and regulatory standards checks for agri-food products. In leaving the EU, the UK swapped a deep trade relationship with few impediments to trade for one where a wide range of checks, forms, and steps are required before goods can cross the border. Firms faced higher costs and passed most of these to consumers, said Richard Davis, a professor at Bristol University and co-author of the report. He said the rise in non-tariff barriers, NTBs, for trade with the EU had contributed to 11% inflation the UK is experiencing, the highest in 40 years. One benefit of Brexit was that domestic food producers now faced less competition from European imports, the report noted. But it added the gains to domestic firms are outstripped by the loss to domestic consumers by more than £1 billion. Additionally, unlike regular tariffs, NTBs do not generate any revenue for the government. Nicole Dutta, assistant professor of economics at Warwick University and co-author of the study, said, "The policy implications are stark. Non-tariff barriers are an important impediment to trade that should be a first-order concern, at least on a par with tariffs, for policymakers interested in low consumer prices." Also, RT noted leaving the European Union added an average of £210 or $258 to British household food bills over the 2 years to the end of 2021. New research from London School of Economics, LSE Centre for Economic Performance, has found. According to the research published recently, Brexit cost British consumers a total of £5.8 billion or $7 billion. The study confirmed that food bills soared 6%, hitting low-income households hardest. Brexit-induced price rises added 1.1% to their total cost of living, more than the 0.7% increase felt by wealthier households. The report highlighted that the rise in consumer prices was driven by products with high non-tariff barriers, while there was no significant rise in those with low non-tariff barriers. That could mean that EU exporters and UK importers faced higher costs due to the new barriers, 50% to 88% of which they passed on to consumers, it said. RT noted trade between the UK and the EU remains tariff-free under the rules of the Brexit agreement. However, extensive customs checks, rules of origin requirements, and sanitary measures for trade in animals and plants have been adding to the pressure on importers and exporters. The LSE study also found that while domestic UK food producers have benefited from less competition, their gains were outstripped by consumer losses to the tune of over £1 billion or $1.2 billion. Moreover, the gains did not generate any revenue for the government. Richard Davies, a professor at Bristol University and co-author of the study, said, "In leaving the EU, the UK swapped a deep trade relationship with few impediments to trade for one where a wide range of checks, forms, and steps are required before goods can cross the border." He pointed out that the UK inflation rate rose above 11% in 2020, the highest rate in 40 years. Britain voted to leave the EU in June 2016, which was followed by several years of tense negotiations before it officially left the Union in January 2020 and exited the Single Market and Customs Union in January 2021.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, this is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the pleasure to be the host of this episode of Point of View. I am Bita at your service, and with me I have two dear guest speakers, my dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And my dear brother, Muhammad, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure too to have you in here in this controversial discussion, which I'm really interested in. So we're going to go through our topic today, which is actually voluntary public forces that we call it as basij in our own country. You're telling me that there is a strong connection between these kind of leaders, these people who just persuade other people to come for this aid and for helping others in different aspects. But the thing I want to ask you right now is, how about non-Islamic countries? Do they have other leaders like that? Or they literally have public voluntary forces or something like that? Or no, they are trying to have something like this. What is the story about that?
Yeah, they tried. Kind of if you look at the Arab uprising, the so-called Arab Spring recently, that's what they were trying to do in Egypt and in Tunisia and stuff. The people themselves, though, you see, you have to consider the strong leadership as well. What lacked, in my opinion, in this Arab Spring was the proper leadership. And that's what made it just, you know, go away in that instance. And it had a lot of negative effects as well. With a proper leadership and this public voluntary force, a movement would be successful. And you brought up the question about more modern ways. The best and the most way of, you know, more ethically approaching a movement is through a public voluntary force.
Yeah.
Other ways, you see coup d'etat, you see, for example, military takeover of a government, of a movement. These are not ethical. These are forces.
I want to add a complimentary point to the explanations of the brother. And just to cover your previous and this question of yours. Actually, you said that it might not work today because we are highly developed and the countries or, I don't know, communities might not be in need of such.
Not only these, but I think the modern civilization, the modern society is somehow more selfish than the past time. Mm-hmm. And also, this is the main problem.
Exactly. I wanted to say that this movement itself is something against selfishness of the societies because it is something that brings people to involve for their own affairs. So this is the involvement of masses of the nation for their own sakes, right? So do you think that people would get stuck in case they are just for your own affair, for your family, for the people in your vicinity? You are going to do a service and give a service to the people around.
Yeah.
See, that's why they are motivated with this, actually, motivation that this is something for the betterment of the life of other Muslims or other, let's say, neighbors of yours. So we see that it's still today, it's still this concept and this movement is valid and it works. And to this question of yours that you asked lastly, on the other countries, are they able to have such a thing? I think when we have taken this model from Islam, I mean, a model from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so it means that all Muslim countries and even non-Muslim countries can take some lessons from that.
Yeah, we have seen that, for example. It comes from a godly source.
Yeah, it comes from a divine and godly source. Then look, as we saw in the history that many leaders of the world have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, from the kind of, let's say, freedom and freedom seeking that he injected to the soul of the people after him. You see, we have some people who are not following Islam and they are not actually Muslims in general, but Muslims at all, but they are actually saying that they have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The same way that people from, specifically from Islamic Ummah, to take their lesson from the Holy Prophet and to involve people in their own affairs. In case you see a Muslim country is needless of such movement and activity, we have to doubt. It means that there is a, let's say, gap between the let's say administration and the nation.
Yeah.
You see, in case these gaps are available, these forces would be more weak and even they might not exist. But in countries that the people are going to involve in their own affairs, in their own issues of the of their own country, like what happened in Syria. And look, Syria, there was a great gap in between the administration and the nation. But slowly, slowly, the gap was filled with these, let's say, mobilization forces. And they came to help Syria with that, let's say, great fitna or great...
sedition.
Great sedition that they were afflicted with. So they actually survived Syria with that. Yeah. And now we in our vicinity in Iraq, the group which is called Hashd al-Sha'bi, the same way that actually they took the idea and they imitated, I can't say, I don't know, even from ours or even from the dawn of Islam, it depends on them from where they have taken this source.
You know, I have a problem here that, you know, you are telling me that, okay, this motivation comes from the Islam, in Islamic contents, Islamic beliefs, the leadership and something. And you told me that when the gap is somehow more in a country you are living in, between your leadership and the administration and the nation, this besiege or I don't know, the public voluntary force is somehow weakened. But my question is that if the motivation is that, so when, for example, I immigrate to another country, what should I do? Is it my responsibility to go for public voluntary forces? Is it my responsibility to, for example, to go help when I'm in another country? I mean that. Is it an act of a nationalism or something?
No, necessarily. It's not an act of nationalism. You see, there the one aspect of besiege of the public voluntary force is actually to build the country, that's for sure. But the more important aspect is to safeguard the country, safeguard the people from ideologies that might affect the movement itself, right? The Islamic movement itself. That's why, as I mentioned previously as well, one of the very key aspects of this public voluntary force is the leadership of this public voluntary force. You might find very patriotic people in a country who are very much, aggrieved of the situation of their countries, and they want the management to change. They want to bring, and they have that public voluntary force ready, but there is no leadership. And that's why the governments are able to, you know, suppress them and take control of them with the military that they have. But with a proper leadership in the center of this besiege, this public voluntary force will be able to flourish that country, not only in the military areas, not only in the areas where you mentioned. And I'm not saying specific to Iran. Anywhere you go, the success to an Islamic movement was besieged. So if you go to a country, even if you migrate outside of Iran, and you see, for example, Islamic communities, right? Those Islamic communities that are administered and operated, and their main human resource is this public voluntary force of that masjid, of that community, they were more successful than those who have this kind of leader-only, you know, opinion.
One more point I want to add that Islam is usually against all different formats of isms like that of nationalism or I don't know, humanism, all different formats of that. Islam is in favor of giving the service to humanity. And in defining this humanity, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't tell you that this humanity that I'm talking about is necessarily Muslim.
Yeah.
No, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says if you save the one's life, it's as if you save the whole people's lives. The whole world's lives. So that, what does it mean? Allah never told you in case you save one the life of a Muslim. You see, so it has a generality. When we are talking about this movement and their functionality, it doesn't matter if we are living in this country or the other country. As far as we are going to give a service to human beings, so we are in this circle. So we are going to be known as the members of the circle to be at the service of humanity. The same way that we serve them, they might or might not serve to us.
So there is a personality needed for this mindset, if you do agree with me. For example, you are going to sacrifice your life, for example, in a military side of a country, for a country, to save other people. And for doing that, there should, you have to be a kind of personality to do that, if you do agree with me.
So that's why it's not compulsory.
It is not, but, you know,
even inside our country, even in our country, it's not something compulsory. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, said that I wish that we have 20 million of, at that time, that the population of Iran was almost 60. Oh, sorry, it was 55 something. Imam said that I wish that we have 20 million of Basij members. So I mean that for 55 million, 20 million can handle all the affairs of the society. I mean, to help them in case they are in need.
My question is, how can we be from that part? You know what I mean? I think you have to be somehow qualified for being from this public voluntary force. But nowadays, even your generation is just don't tend to that much do such a thing, for example, for his own people, even for his own sake. You know what I mean? I mean that we should have somehow a systematic, actually, motivation for this youth generation. But what is it? Where is it?
Definitely, these motivations are not quite the same in different years and in different ages. Sometimes it is more stronger, sometimes they are weaker.
Yeah.
Look, at times that even there is an issue of martyrdom and shahada, usually this motivation goes higher. And we see that the members are usually more. At the time of the imposed war between Iran and Iraq, because the numbers of shahada, even blood is quite a famous saying, that blood brings life.
Yeah.
When lots of blood, almost 200,000 of the youth of this country got martyred, so it means that this motivation makes them stronger. I want to give you another example. At the time that Colonel Soleimani got martyred, have you seen the population who came just to participate in his funeral? It means that when there is a blood and the blood is for an important person, it gives a bigger life to the whole society and Ummah. So it gives them this motivation to have more, to get more motivated, to get motivated more to join such forces. Yes, at times, for example, at the time of Quran, as you said, we had less because people were at homes and they'd be busy with their own problems and the diseased ones, and there was sort of, let's say, sorrow in the people. So definitely the people who joined them were less. But all in all, if you want to find a statistic of the number of the people who joined and are still members of Basij, not only in Iran, but also in Iraq and Syria and other neighboring countries like Yemen or even countries outside Asia, you see, the majority of the members of them are youth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you...
Just to compliment Brother Ali's point, I'll also like to touch upon the public voluntary force of Lebanon, Hezbollah, and he talked about how when there is blood, life is even more empowered. The reason is because the most important, the most valued thing for a human being is his own life. When you see your brother take that step, your brother or your sister take that step in risking his life for yours, you understand that how valuable he sees you and your movement.
Yeah.
And so that's why in the war between Lebanon and Israel, Hezbollah and Israel, you will see that a force of, a couple of hundred voluntary youths from Lebanon. And they weren't fighting for their, necessarily their land. They were fighting against oppression. And that is very much clear. They weren't the reason was because they had entered their land. But they were fighting, their motivation was to fight against oppression. Hezbollah, with all their, forces they have, couple of hundred, probably one or two helicopters, not much, artilleries. But Israel, with all the high technology they had and all the forces they had, they were not able to combat this voluntary public force.
Yeah.
Because of the power it gives. And this way, when the Hezbollahi soldiers, they would enter into the battlefield, they would enter to give life. But on the other side, when they would come, they would enter to save their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the more they went ahead, the further the enemy was backing off.
So I want to make a challenge for you. Just let me one sentence that you can make me motivated for going for public voluntary force. Just one sentence. You first, Brother Ali, please.
It doesn't need any reason. You can, the same way that Imam Hussein sacrificed his own life and his own family. We cannot even imagine that 18 people from one family get martyred and killed in one day for the, for the lives of others.
So
for the, and for the others to get saved.
So as you see, this is a really difficult task to have a motivation, have a united motivation for something to do. And public voluntary force is something which is public, and you have to be actually united for this public thing to be done. And I think it is really difficult, and I'm really proud of the history of the Islamic history, actually, which showed to the world that it is possible to make all the people think in a right way. way, and not all of them, actually the majority of people think in a right way and go for that, do something for that and sacrifice something for this.
Definitely. I like to suggest all the brothers and sisters who are listening to this show just to read the story of Shahrukh. This is a book that has been about a person from Basij that entered the... it is one of the miracles of this movement that this person was quite a different person that entered this Basij and finally he got martyred.
Actually, thank you for your suggestion. Thank you, my dear brothers, for the discussion of today. I hope you enjoyed all of it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except Allah. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Economists believe the world is heading towards an economic recession with the misguided policies of the United States and Europe in raising interest rates. The United Nations has criticized the United States and European countries that have adopted raising interest rates as a way of dealing with high prices and rising inflation. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse news agency writes, the U.S. Federal Reserve is pegged to make a fourth straight steep hike in the key interest rate in coming days as it battles surging costs, with its aggressive stance fueling expectations of a recession. American households have been squeezed by soaring consumer prices, propelling economic issues to the top spot among voter concerns in the upcoming midterm elections. U.S. Federal Reserve officials walk a tightrope to try and rein in prices while avoiding a downturn. To raise borrowing costs and cool demand, the U.S. Central Bank has already cranked up the benchmark lending rate 5 times this year, including 3 straight 0.75 percentage point raises. But with persistently high inflation and a tight labor market supporting wages and spending, analysts say another 0.75 percentage point hike is almost certain at the central bank's next policy meeting. The policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee started its 2-day policy meeting on Tuesday, 25th of October, and all eyes are on signals that it may be ready to slow its campaign in the months ahead. A Barclays analysis said there will be a focus on whether the committee is confident of being on track towards a policy stance restrictive enough to manage inflation risks. Many economists expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates again by another 0.5 percentage point in December. The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has made it clear that there is no painless way to cool the economy and avoid a repeat of the last time U.S. inflation got out of control in the 1970s and early 1980s. It took tough action and a recession to bring down prices, and the U.S. Federal Reserve is unwilling to give up its hard-won inflation-fighting credibility. Nancy Van Den Houten, U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, says, we've been told again and again that the Federal Reserve would continue to raise interest rates aggressively until it sees compelling evidence that inflation is slowing down. I don't think the data so far meets that standard. The Fed's actions have rippled through the U.S. economy, with mortgage rates hitting their highest in decades recently, and home sales sliding. Further U.S. Federal Reserve interest hikes are also expected to dampen consumer and business spending, making it more attractive to save rather than to spend. ABC News has covered the same story. More than half of Americans are considering taking on extra jobs to be able to pay for everyday expenses and meet the rising cost of living as inflation remains stubbornly high. According to a new study by Qualtrics, a software technology company, employees in the United States are combating the soaring prices of essentials like groceries, housing, and gas by looking for ways to increase their incomes and cut down on expenses. The survey of more than 1,000 full-time employees found that 38% of workers have looked for a second job, while another 14% are planning to do so. Qualtrics chief workplace psychologist Dr. Benjamin Granger says, with budgets tightening, workers are searching for ways to meet the rising cost of living, including finding new jobs. The new opinion poll states working parents are especially pinched, as nearly 70% said their pay isn't keeping up with costs. About 47% of employees with children have looked for a second job, higher than the rate of workers overall. According to a recent Brookings Institution estimate, the cost of raising a child through high school has surged to more than $300,000, up roughly $26,000 from 2 years ago. It's not unusual for American workers to have multiple jobs, especially with more people tapping into the gig economy and doing independently managed work like freelancing or growing a side hustle. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports as of September, 7.8 million Americans are working more than one job, making up 4.9% of the total U.S. workforce. A record 440,000 Americans were working 2 full-time positions in August, compared to 308,000 in February of 2020. High inflation and easing COVID-19 concerns may be prompting more people to look for seasonal work this winter. At the same time, employers are pulling back from 2021's hot holiday hiring levels and offering fewer incentives to prospective workers. The British newspaper The Daily Mail writes, half of Americans say runaway inflation and high living costs are taking a toll on their health, as millions of people turn to drink, junk food and smoking more as worries mount over electricity and gas bills this winter. Research at Toluna, a consumer insights firm, found that 50% of those surveyed were feeling their health suffer as a result of the cost of living crisis, with inflation currently running above 8%, according to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Among them, 37% said they were feeling more stressed, 21% said they were eating less healthily, and 16% said they were smoking more, and 13% were drinking alcohol more often. The survey of 1,000 people comes as inflation, crime and immigration are at the front of voters' minds ahead of the November 8 midterm elections, which will decide whether Republicans or Democrats control Congress. A recent projection by Bloomberg says the U.S. economy was 100% likely to plunge into a recession within the next year. Previously, economists had only estimated a 60% chance of a recession. Matt Booth, a researcher on the survey, said, as we move further into the cost of living crisis, the impact it is starting to show now. He added, it's affecting everything from our personal health to how we plan our grocery shopping and where we are cutting back to save money. The opinion poll showed nearly 3/4 of Americans said they were worried by the rising cost of electricity and gas. As consumers face steep increases in pricing, heating oil, propane and other fuels in the coming colder months. Nearly 2/3 of those surveyed said the energy crisis and the rising cost of living were affecting their spending plans. Large numbers of respondents said they would cut back on eating, that is 37%, or they would order takeouts, 23%, or buy cheaper items, 21%.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.